We're delighted that you're here. In 1926, Dallas Seminary established the W.H. Griffith Thomas Memorial Lectureship in honor of William Henry Griffith Thomas, one of the founding fathers of our seminary. Over the years, the academic departments have taken turns inviting prominent scholars to deliver the lectures that are designed to be a scholarly treatment of significant issues in their field of study and vocational experience. One of the purposes of the lectureship is to provide the seminary community with exposure to a variety of scholars from different theological perspectives, yet within the evangelical community. This year, the Old Testament Studies Department has invited Dr. Daniel Block as our guest lecturer for this week of extended chapel services. Dr. Block occupies the John R. Sampey Professor of Old Testament Interpretation Chair at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Previously, he served as professor of Hebrew and Old Testament at Bethel Theological Seminary in Minnesota, assistant lecturer in Hebrew at the University of Liverpool in England, and professor of Old Testament at Providence College and Seminary in Canada. He earned his MA in Biblical Studies, Old Testament, at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in 1973, and a doctorate of philosophy in Semitics and Classical Hebrew from the University of Liverpool in England in 1982. He has also done postdoctoral studies at Cambridge University in 2002. He is the author of numerous articles, both scholarly and popular, on Old Testament texts and subjects. His most significant publications include a major two-volume commentary on the book of Ezekiel and a commentary on Judges and Ruth. He lectures and preaches frequently at Bible conferences and spiritual retreats, but his passion for the kingdom of God is also reflected in his commitment to the local church. He and his wife Ellen are heavily involved in the ministry of North Oldham Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. They are both natives of Saskatchewan, Canada. They have two children, a daughter and a son, and each of them within their marriage have a daughter and a son in that order. So he is the proud grandfather of four grandchildren, along with his wife Ellen. We're delighted that Dr. Block is with us. I had the privilege of sitting in one of his lectures at the Evangelical Theological Society meetings this past fall, so I have been anxiously looking forward to this week for a number of months now. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Block to our chapel here at Dallas Seminary?
It is a joy to greet you this morning in the name of the Lord, whom we are honored to serve. Mr. President, esteemed faculty, staff, and students, I consider it an extraordinary privilege to have been invited to deliver the Griffith Thomas Lectures here in 2004. The influence of Griffith Thomas in my life may be indirect, but it is nonetheless very real. Who knows, but if it hadn't been for Dr. Thomas, I probably wouldn't be here. I say this on two counts. First, I was raised in the Mennonite Brethren faith in rural Saskatchewan, a region that was heavily influenced by the thorough biblical instruction and clearly defined theological perspectives represented by Dallas Theological Seminary, which Dr. Thomas had a hand in founding. And secondly, and probably more directly, when my father, an immigrant from Russia to Canada in 1926, made the switch from preaching in German to preaching in English in the 1950s, among his most treasured writings were the works of Griffith Thomas on the one hand, and the writings of this venerable faculty from this institution on the other. My father would be extremely delighted if he were alive and could witness in person my presence on your campus. You have no idea how deeply honored I am to stand before you this morning. I propose in the next four chapel services to deal with four small sections of the book of Deuteronomy that have become very precious to me. I really am somewhat hesitant to do this here, inasmuch as my good friend Eugene Merrill has written such a superb commentary on the book. Who can add anything to what he has written? On the other hand, inasmuch as Moses' words have been ringing in my ears for the last 2 or 3 years as I have been working my way through this book, it seemed appropriate for me to take this opportunity to share with you some of the insights that God in His unspeakable mercy has granted me, and to seek your counsel on matters of interpretation where I am either wrong or in need of further refinement. In the coming lectures, I propose to explore 4 areas of Mosaic teaching that may help us not only to understand Israelite faith in a bygone era, but also to assist us in our own understanding of these issues for today. I propose to deal with, as God wills, the grace of Torah this morning, the Mosaic prescription for life, the joy of worship, the Mosaic invitation to the presence of God tomorrow, the burden of leadership, the Mosaic paradigm of kingship on Thursday, and then the privilege of calling, the Mosaic plan for missions on Friday. We begin this morning then with the grace of Torah. I would like to begin by drawing your attention to a question, a very important question that is asked in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 20. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, "What do the statutes and the ordinances and the judgments which the Lord our God commanded you mean? What is the meaning of this?" Now, the form in which Moses casts the question and the answer arise out of the everyday experience of parents trying to raise your children. Now, I'm sure some of you who are parents, you've had the kind of experience we had in our house when our son was in the early years of his high school experience. We were having a very animated supper conversation, and suddenly he just blurted out, "Why do we have to live in such a prehistoric family?" Now, the tone was less than commendable, but on the other hand, I took that to be a compliment. He was recognizing that there is something about our household that was counterculture, and he was asking for an explanation. Moses is dealing with that kind of situation. The point is that succeeding generations will not have a memory of the experiences that the people standing before him have shared, either of Yahweh's revelation at Sinai or Moses' present interpretation of that revelation. Therefore, it will be necessary for this and all subsequent generations to be very intentional in transmitting their faith to the next generation. As in every social context and every age, the children will watch the way their parents live, and especially when faced with a challenge of competing cultures, they will be curious about the nature and rationale behind their own traditions. Moses assumes that the children will ask their parents for an explanation of their way of life. The specific question he anticipates here concerns the covenant stipulations, ha'edoth, the ordinances, Hachukim, and the regulations, Hamishpatim, that Yahweh has commanded Israel to observe. These 3 expressions function as shorthand for the totality of the will of God as it had been revealed primarily at Horeb and then to a lesser degree en route to the Promised Land. The question assumes a package, all the moral, ceremonial, and civil regulations that God has prescribed. As illustrated so impressively in Leviticus 19, there is to be no division of life into the sacred and the ordinary. When children observe how their parents conduct their private and family lives, how they carry on their social and economic relations, and how they worship, then they will inquire concerning the meaning of it all. Of course, what the children's question calls for is not a detailed exposition of each of the 613 laws in the Pentateuch, but an explanation of the significance of the whole package. In short, why is it that our lives are governed by this curious set of principles? What is the significance of this set of laws? Now, if we were to ask that question of you this morning, or of our other evangelicals in America in this day, we would come up with several different answers. There are some of us who would say, when I read the laws in the Old Testament, I shake my head with bewilderment and wonder seriously whether there is any point at all. When you read something like, whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the animals you may eat, nevertheless among those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these. The camel, because it chews the cud but doesn't part the hoof, is unclean. The rock badger, because it chews the cud but doesn't part the hoof, is unclean. And the hare, because it chews the cud but does not part the hoof, is unclean. Isn't that glorious? That'll warm your heart. Now, if you're not bewildered by these kinds of laws, we may actually feel sorry for the Israelites. What a burden! Surely many must have looked on the nations all around and wished, I were not saddled with this business. Well, some of us might have that interest. Others of us might look at these laws in a more objective way and see in them a very interesting window into the society of ancient Israel. Those who are familiar with the ancient Near Eastern legal world would, of the second millennium BC, might even conclude that these laws represent a significant advance, for instance, over the law code of Hammurabi. And so we do these sociological and legal analyses. However, my suspicion is that many of us wouldn't have answered the question either of these ways. In our day, in contemporary Western evangelicalism, many would probably have answered the question something like, well, do you know what the significance of the law was for Israel? For Israel, the law was a way of salvation. Whereas in the New Testament, people are saved by grace, under the Old Covenant, people were saved by keeping the law. I asked my students in the first class of the Old Testament introduction class a couple of years ago, how were people saved in the Old Testament? And that's what I got. The only trouble with this view is that it flies in the face of Paul's explicit statements that even in the Old Testament, people like Abraham were justified by faith rather than through obedience to the law. In fact, some of us go to the other extreme. We view the law not as a way of salvation, but as the way of death. And we quote Paul to buttress our position, for does he not say that the law brings about wrath? We have now been released from the law, having died to that to which we are bound. As many as of the works of the law are under a curse, and the law is not of faith, and Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. These verses seem to offer a rather clear answer to the question that Moses raised. The significance of the law lies in its power to bind those who are under the law, to subject them to the curse and the wrath of God, and to demonstrate their desperate need of a Savior. Now, while on the surface, this seems to be the way the New Testament perceives the law, it raises serious questions concerning both the justice and the mercy of God. How and why would God rescue the Israelites from the burdensome and death-dealing slavery of Egypt, only to impose upon them an even heavier burden of the law, which they in any case were unable to keep, and which would sentence them to an even more horrible fate, damnation under His wrath? When you look at it this way, the Exodus doesn't turn out to be such a good deal after all. But I wonder what, if we have ever bothered to ask what Moses, for instance, thought about the law. Now, it is very important that we interpret Scripture with Scripture, and when we go to Paul for the answers to these, we are doing that. But it seems that we sometimes move far too quickly to later reflection and use of these texts than the immediate context. So that this morning, I would like to look at two texts which help us answer the question. Moses has already provided one of his answers earlier in chapter 4, at the end of his first address. to his people gathered on the plains of Moab. In chapter 4, verse 1 to 8, and I wish we had time to deal with all of this in detail, but here he is reflecting on the significance of the law. We'll pick it up for the sake of time at verse 5, noting that in the earlier verses, he has already told us that the Torah that he is teaching is normative and canonical by definition. You shall not remove anything from it nor add anything to it. If that isn't a statement of canonicity, I don't know what is. Second, he has already said that the Torah is the key to life. You here standing before me today are witnesses of this. Those who were not obedient to the law, they died at Baal Peor. But then he comes to his third position. The knowledge of the Torah that he is teaching is the highest privilege imaginable. Look at verses 6 to 8 of chapter 4. See, I've taught you statutes and judgments just as the Lord my God commanded me that you should do thus in the land where you're entering to possess. So keep them and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, wow, what a great nation, how wise and understanding this people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God whenever we call upon him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole Torah that I am setting before you today? Now, in these verses, Moses puts himself in the shoes of the nations around Israel who will observe how they live and draw some rather remarkable conclusions. Conclusions that catch many a modern reader by surprise. Now, the chances are rather good that if some of us had written verses 6 and 7, we would have written something like this. Look then, you must keep the commandments and do them, for that is your duty and your obligation in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this is an unfortunate nation. It is a sorrowful and burdened people. Of course, that's how many of us view what the Israelites were under. Now, if the present context doesn't help us appreciate what Moses is saying, perhaps we should actually ask the nations about whom he's talking. What do you say about this? Well, to help us understand the perspective of the nations on the Torah that the Israelites have received, let me draw your attention to a prayer written in Sumerian. I don't read Sumerian, but we do have access to a translation. Probably dating back to the second millennium, but preserved in the library of Ashurbanipal. The text is very repetitious. I wish I had time to read the whole thing so that we would get the rhetorical point. So I will abbreviate some of it. It's called A Prayer to Every God. Now, as I read this, you need to know that this is how the rest of the world is thinking about these matters. May the fury of the Lord's heart be quieted toward me. May the God who is not known be quieted toward me. May the goddess who is not known be quieted toward me. May the goddess whom I know or do not know be quieted toward me. May the goddess who has become angry with me be quieted toward me. In ignorance I have eaten the forbidden of my God. In ignorance I have set foot on that prohibited by my goddess. O Lord, my transgressions are many. Great are my sins. O my God, my transgressions are great. Many are my sins. The transgressions that I have committed, I don't know. The sin that I have done, indeed, I do not know. The forbidden thing that I have eaten, indeed, I do not know. The prohibited place on which I have set foot, indeed, I do not know. But the God in the anger of his heart looked at me. The God in the rage of his heart confronted me. When the goddess was angry with me, she made me become ill. The God whom I know or do not know has oppressed me. The goddess whom I know or do not know has placed suffering upon me. Although I am constantly looking for help, no one takes me by the hand. When I weep, they do not come to my side. I utter laments, but no one hears me. I am troubled. I am overwhelmed. I cannot see. O my God, merciful one, I address to you the prayer. Incline to me. I kiss the feet of my goddess. I crawl before you. How long, O my goddess, whom I know or do not know, before your hostile heart will be quieted? Man is dumb. He knows nothing. Mankind, everyone that exists, what does he know? Whether he is committing sin or doing good, he doesn't even know. Oh, my Lord, do not cast your servant down. He is plunged into the waters of a swamp. Take him by the hand. The sin that I have done, turn into goodness. The transgression I have committed, let the wind carry away. Oh, goddess whom I know or do not know, remove my transgressions and I will sing your praise. May your heart, like the heart of a real mother, be quieted toward me, like a real mother and a real father. May it be quieted toward me. Now, isn't that pathetic? And what an indictment this prayer is on the religious systems of the world around Israel. This person cannot escape the wretched fact that he is faced with three insurmountable problems. First, he doesn't know which God he has offended. Second, he doesn't know what the offense is. And third, he doesn't know what it will take to make it right. Now, it's against this backdrop what we need to hear the Torah. With their clear knowledge of the will of Yahweh, the faithful in Israel perceive themselves as incredibly privileged and the envy of the nations. Unlike other peoples whose gods of wood and stone crafted by human hands neither saw nor heard nor smelled, Yahweh hears his people when they call upon him. And unlike the nations whose idols have mouths but they do not speak, Israel's God has spoken. By his grace, he has given his people statutes and judgments that are perfect and righteousness, perfect because, one, they reveal with perfect clarity who he is. Oh my God, whom I know or do not know. He reveals himself by name. Second, they reveal with perfect clarity what sin is. Did you hear that? The forbidden thing that I have eaten. I don't know what it was, but I must have eaten something. Or where I stepped. And third, they reveal with perfect clarity how that sin may be removed and a relationship of peace and confidence may be established. It's against this backdrop that we need to hear David in Psalm 32. Congratulations. Oh, the privilege of one whose sin is forgiven, whose transgressions are removed. What is the meaning of the Torah for Israel? Let me tell you, to the ancient Israelites, the people in Israel of faith, it was the supreme privilege to know the will of God. But then let's go back to our primary text, Deuteronomy chapter 6, where we see Moses' second answer to the question. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of these statutes and ordinances and laws? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves in Egypt, and Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and Yahweh showed signs and wonders great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to our forefathers. Come on, Moses, answer the question. What is the meaning of these laws? Oh, and then he finally says, and Yahweh commanded us to practice all these statutes as an expression of the fear of our fear of Yahweh, our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to practice this entire commandment before Yahweh, our God, as he has commanded us. There's the answer. Now, this little text, this little paragraph has been called a family catechism. Indeed, what you have here is a four-sentence exposition at the beginning of it, which really is an exposition of the first word of the Decalogue. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It's a four-point sermon on that text first. With this response, Moses declares that the primary issue driving an Israelite, a true Israelite's life, is not a system of rules, but knowledge of the salvation that Yahweh has wrought on their behalf through the exercise of mighty power. Obedience to the revealed will of God is presented as the response to the glorious gospel of salvation, as evidence of fear and love for Him, and a mark of gratitude for all that He has done for them. A life ordered by the stipulations of the covenant is their response to their own history. Now, within this context, the giving of the law must be seen as another climactic moment of grace. Taken as a whole, within the context of what comes before and what follows, Yahweh's rescue of Israel was an act of both soteriological and judicial significance. When He freed them from Egypt, He freed His chosen people from slavish vassaldom to Egypt and claimed them as His own vassals, a status symbolized by the stipulations, decrees, and laws. But these laws are not to be viewed as burdens laid on their shoulders, knowing that it was so heavy no one could carry it. This is not grace. That is tyranny and deceit. In Moses' eyes, to have received the revelation of God was a supreme privilege, along with the privilege of their salvation, and along with the privilege of God's providence in the desert, bringing them to this point, and along with the privilege of God's granting them the land. Now, I wonder if when our children ask us why we have to go to church, why we have to live by such old-fashioned standards, why we have to put money in the offering and go and serve in soup kitchens and all the rest of that good stuff, I wonder if we say, well, yeah, that's how we were taught. That's what we have to do. We're Christians. You know, there are a lot of people who live like that. I wish I weren't a Christian. I wouldn't have to do all this stuff. And if I weren't a Christian, my conscience wouldn't bother me if I swindled a little as I scratched my way to the top. We've got a lot of Christians out there living that way, for whom life as a Christian is a burden. It's a code of laws, do's and don'ts. How different is Moses' response? Do you want to know the significance of all these stipulations and laws? They represent the glorious privilege the redeemed Israelites had of being bond servants of the Lord. In fact, in chapter 14, verse 1, he will talk about them, he will refer to the Israelites as sons of God, His special treasure, His holy people. What a glorious privilege. These revealed ordinances provided a way of saying thank you to God for the salvation He has offered in the Exodus, for the delight of being His covenant people, and the privilege of receiving the promised land as a gift. Obedience to God should be a delight. What a perversion it is in our day. Two kinds of perversions. There's one perversion that treats the law as a burden, a complex series of obligations by which I earn my salvation. That's legalism. But the other side is just as perverse. The other side looks at the law as something from which I have been delivered. And now that the righteousness of Christ has been imputed to me, I can live like I please. And our theme song has become, free from the law, oh happy condition, now I can sin without fear of perdition. Hey, we've got a lot of people out there like that. I lived in a Lutheran community for a while. And you couldn't tell church people from non-church people, because it had no implications for life. But Moses isn't finished yet. Look at verses 24 to 25. Here he finally gets around to answering the child's question. What then is the significance of the stipulations and the laws and the rules that Yahweh has commanded us? His answer consists of four significant declarations, and we could go till about 2 o'clock on this. First, Moses declares that Yahweh has given Israel the law as a visible means of demonstrating her fear for Him. Do you see this? Yahweh commanded us to practice all these statutes as an expression of fear. Now that's good news. Because the Israelites are told right off the bat, do you want to know what pleases God? It is the ultimate grace to know how to express true fear and faith. Second, Moses declares that Yahweh gave Israel a Torah for her own good, not to be a burden or a noose around their necks, but an incredible benefit. And he spends a lot of time in the book of Deuteronomy telling us what that means. And in this context, it is the good life in the land that God is giving them graciously, as it is summarized in chapter 28, 1 to 14, and other places. For the Israelites, when they receive the law, it is not something that is received to put a ball and chain around their legs, but very liberating. Third, Moses declares that Yahweh gave Israel the Torah that she might live. Of course, in this case, obedience to the law should not be understood as a way of self-redemption, and to live should not be interpreted in a soteriological sense of salvation from sin and the enjoyment of eternal life with God. He is talking to people already redeemed. Did you see that? God did not come to the Israelites in Egypt and say, "All right, as soon as you keep all these commandments, I'll get you out of here." No, he got them out first. And now he is telling them, he's reminding them, you want to live the full life to which God has called you here. According to verses 21 to 23, the divine act of salvation was accomplished 4 decades ago. Now we're looking forward to the fulfillment of the calling to which God has for them. Fourth, Yahweh gave Israel the Torah that she might know his approval. Now this is the most offensive verse of all for many of us. I'm in chapter 4, that's why it's not working. Verse 25, it will be righteousness for us if we believe. Oh no, it doesn't say that. It assumes belief. As close as you get in the Old Testament to the word for faith is probably fear. You shall fear the Lord your God. He's already talked about that. But it will be righteous for us if we are careful to observe all this commandment before the Lord our God. What in the world are we talking about here? It's interesting to see how Deuteronomy, Moses uses the word righteous and righteousness in the book. In the book of Deuteronomy, righteousness has to do with the objective standards of faith and conduct as determined by God and outlined in the covenant stipulations. Our text notes that when a member of the covenant community conscientiously obeys the whole commandment, the Lord will accept it as evidence of righteousness. Isn't that beautiful? This statement is among the most fundamental in the Old Testament for understanding the relationship between human works and human righteousness. Of course, this again is not soteriological works. It is the works of the saint, the works of sanctification. Moses' point here is that the Israelites will demonstrate their loyalty to Yahweh by adherence to the supreme commandment and by concrete acts of obedience to the detailed injunctions. When these arise out of genuine fear and faith, Yahweh accepts them as proof of righteousness and responds with blessing and life. And conversely, it may be assumed that in the absence of obedience, faith is lacking and the covenant relationship rejected, that covenant, that rejection to which Yahweh then responds with a curse of death. But our time is about gone, and we need simply to make some concluding reflections on so what. What is there here for me? First of all, this text reminds us how extremely important it is for us to pass on our tradition to our children. But it also reminds us how extremely important it is to pass on more than the tradition, but the foundation of the tradition, which is the unmerited favor and grace of God. Secondly, this passage teaches clearly the relationship between law and grace within the divine plan of salvation and sanctification. The scriptures are consistent in asserting that no one may perform works of righteousness sufficient to merit the saving favor of God. In the words of Isaiah, all of us have become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous acts are like filthy rags. We all shrivel like a leaf. And in the New Testament, Paul will write, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and the best that we can do is garbage when we're talking salvation. However, within the gospel of salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, the Lord graciously reveals the standard of righteousness by which His redeemed people may live and be confident of His approval. There is no conflict here between law and grace. No, the law is grace. It provided His people long ago with an ever-present reminder of Yahweh's deliverance, His power, His covenant faithfulness, and the way of life and prosperity. But how is this to be reconciled with Paul's unspoken statements concerning the death-dealing effect of the law in contrast to the life that comes by the Spirit? Of course, I can't answer the question fully in three sentences. But let me remind you that Moses' statement concerning the life-giving, sustaining effects of the law is consistent with his teaching elsewhere. It's consistent with Psalm 119. If you feel sorry for the Israelites, just about the time you're down, you know, about that, read Psalm 119. Do you know that there's no place in the Old Testament where anybody ever tells God directly, I love you? Or I love him. Think about that. It has some church implications for what we do these days. Weak point, shout loud. But it is very interesting that in Psalm 193, three times the psalmist says, how I love thy Torah, O Lord. You notice how turned around we've got it. In our presumption, I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice, but I sure hate your law. It is the opposite to what they were doing there. The basic Old Testament stance of the believer, of course, within Israel, there were always two Israels, weren't there? From the very beginning, there were two Israels. And to some, it was merely an external code on tablets of stone. But to the others, it was written on their hearts, and it was a true joy. The second point to be made about Paul is that he is writing occasional letters addressing people who are abusing the law, who are not reading Moses, but abusing Moses. In Romans and Galatians, Paul is responding to those who insist that salvation comes by the works of the law as represented by circumcision. To those who represent this view, he replies that if one looks to the law as a way of salvation, it's a killer. It will lead to death, and the noose gets tighter and tighter. But if one looks to the law as a guide for those already saved, guess what? It yields life. On this matter, Paul and Moses are in perfect agreement. In fact, Paul himself says, it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. Both testaments attest to the same paradigm, which has three points. One, Yahweh's gracious, unmerited, saving actions yield the fruit of a redeemed people. Two, a redeemed people yields the fruit of righteous deeds. Three, righteous deeds yield the fruit of divine blessing. Maybe herein lies the relevance of this text for us. May the Lord give us a sense of gratitude for His salvation. And may He give us a new sense of gratitude for His revelation of His will. May the Lord deliver us from viewing His call for general and specific obedience as a burden. May He fill our hearts and heads with joy and gratitude so that in response to His glorious salvation, we will say with a psalmist and with Jesus, how I delight to do Your will, O God. And then, perhaps, when our children ask us in days to come, what is the meaning of these ordinances, we will be able to say, we were slaves to sin, but the Lord brought us out of the kingdom of darkness and death with a mighty hand. Moreover, the Lord showed great and distressing signs before the prince of the powers of this world and all his followers. He brought us out from there in order to bring us into the eternal and imperishable inheritance that what he had assigned to us, or sworn to us even, before the foundation of the world might be ours. So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes as an expression of our fear and our love for Christ, for our good always, and for our survival as it is today. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe this whole commandment before the Lord, just as he commanded us. Jesus said, if you love me, send roses. No. Write nice music. Send me a Valentine. No. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. He also said that if we keep his commandments out of hearts of faith and love and fear, one day we will hear his well done, good and faithful vassal. Enter into the joy of your master. May that be our portion and our delight this day and evermore. Amen.